this is actually from NVIDIA. So I mentioned NVIDIA research before. They did this research. They built this website. And what they did is they got a big database of images, just pictures of people's faces. And then they trained a new kind of machine learning model that people call deep learning. They trained this to draw new faces of people. So it imagines a person and it draws a face. And these faces are amazing. They're photorealistic, like incredible high quality faces. And so, and you can actually go to this website now. Every time you refresh the page, it will draw a new photorealistic face. So what we do is something very analogous to that. We build big databases of patient level clinical data. And then we train a deep learning model so that it can generate new medical records. So it's actually just like that thing is generating faces. We are generating new medical records.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast, with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Charles Fisher, founder and CEO of Unlearn.ai. Unlearn is a machine learning company in the business of generating digital twins for patients in clinical trials. Why would you want to do that? Well, one factor in the price of new drugs is the cost of clinical trials. Each trial requires a control arm of patients who receive a placebo. The more you know about your patient's population, the more you can shrink the size of this placebo arm and conversely increase the number of patients actually receiving the drug and hopefully reduce the price of the drug. Also, machine learning enables computers to build on what they already know. With the digital twin concept, each new clinical trial will add to a database that can be used to generate virtual placebo patients for new trials of different drugs. Volunteer for one trial and your contribution could be leveraged indefinitely in many future trials. It's just like an Arnold Schwarzenegger sci-fi movie, actually. Before starting Unlearn, Charles was a machine learning engineer at LeapMotion and a computational biologist at Pfizer. He's got a stellar academic record too, with a Harvard PhD. And listen on to hear what he thinks of the difference between industry and academia. And I hope you enjoy our conversation. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite app.
Well, thank you for joining me today, Charles. It's Friday in San Francisco. I don't know, are you based in San Francisco?
Yes, in principle.
Perfect. Because it's kind of cloudy day, but it's Friday after all. Well, thank you for joining me today. And I thought it would be good to start our conversation for our listeners to know a bit more about you. You have quite an interesting background. You do biophysics. And when I think about biophysics, always, you know, I'm thinking like, how is that, you know, translate to something in healthcare? But yet you make that transition. And tell us more about how you pick that field and then how you end up starting this company.
Sure. So biophysics is interesting because it's really not clear what it is in a lot of ways. So my journey to biophysics started at the University of Michigan, and I was studying biochemistry and math, so originally. And somebody from, they were creating a new program actually in biophysics. So this was a brand new major. And they approached me and they said, Charles, biochemistry and math is two majors. You could just do one major of biophysics.
Buy one, get one free kind of deal.
And I was like, well, that sounds better. So I switched in and then did biophysics. So my graduating class, I think, was four people. So there are four of us who initially did biophysics at Michigan.
How is it different from biophysics and physics?
So, I mean, they're definitely different. So biophysics is kind of the idea, I think, of applying concepts from physics. So mathematical modeling, different types of maybe computer modeling, different types of experimental techniques to studying problems in biology. Mm-hmm. And this, it's very, very broad. So I am a theoretical biophysicist. So that means basically, you could also say I'm a mathematical biologist or computational biologist. They're all very similar things. I use math to study biology. There are other people who use physical techniques to study biology, so spectroscopy and those kinds of things. Right. And all of that is considered biophysics, even though it's all very different. After college, I went to Harvard to study biophysics, get my PhD, and I worked on computer simulations of protein folding. Actually working on simulations of proteins that don't fold, which is a kind of an interesting twist to thinking about the protein folding problem. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Boston University and École Normale Supérieure in Paris, staying in academia for a while, working on different applications of kind of machine learning to problems in biology, before eventually finding my way to Pfizer Pharmaceuticals back in Boston, where I was a machine learning scientist, thinking about how machine learning could be used in clinical trials.
Was that at that moment when you joined Pfizer, is that a new field for them too? Or they've been always thinking about using machine learning for a long time?
So it depends what we really want to classify as machine learning. Data science and statistics have always been, important components of pharmaceutical research. I mean, certainly for the last, 30, 40 years as we've had computers. And I think the real distinction between machine learning and those other fields is really the amount that we rely on computers. So instead of taking, something that you can put on your laptop and, you can fit the model in Excel, we might build more complicated things that you need a big supercomputer. And it might run for like a few weeks, So that's relatively new because, as computer power has really increased in the past, 10 or 15 years. So there was a small group of people, maybe about 5 people when I was there, who were really doing kind of machine learning as opposed to kind of data science and other things. And I know that, across pharma, though, that was, I don't know, 6 years ago or something, I was at Pfizer. It's grown really dramatically, right, since in those 6 years. So, and I really do think that a big part of it is some of it's due to the availability of data and starting to aggregate disparate data sets that used to be very siloed, putting them together to build data sets that you can learn from. But it's also just access to computing. Amazon Web Services and Google Cloud Services, like this ability that where anyone can really get access to really high performance computing has also really changed the game for everybody. So it was relatively new at the time within Pfizer, but they were kind of just starting to get into it.
So what did you learn from your experience at Pfizer that kind of propelled you to think about what you're doing now?
Well, I learned a lot of things. So first of all, it was just my first industry job. So I just had to learn the difference between academia and industry. And that is an adjustment.
Like what kind of things that you felt like shocking revelation?
I don't think there was a shocking revelation about the difference. It was more just that there's a difference in incentives between academia and in industry. So, honestly, I actually think that industry, even though we have like people think about business as being competitive, in academia is competitive.
Oh,
industry,
yeah.
Industry is collaborative, right? Like
yeah.
You're working at Pfizer, you've got 5,000 or I don't know how many employees, more than 5,000. I got a lot of employees and you're all working towards the same goal. So it's very, very different. And I think that collaboration takes a little bit to break away from this individual academic idea, like it's all about my research, into it being about the company's goals. Take some adjustment. I think in terms of insights, though, that led me to thinking about unlearn, really came to what we were doing in clinical trials. So, a lot of the work that we would do is we would collect data in like a phase 2 clinical trial, and we might get data from 200 people, something like that. And then we would want to apply some kind of machine learning method to learn from those data, use it to predict who's going to respond to the therapy or something like that, and improve subsequent trials, try to make them more likely to succeed. And 200 people is a very small sample of people from a machine learning perspective. And so one of the things that I really sort of took away from that experience was that in order to really, say, leverage clinical trial data or clinical data for real machine learning applications, it was going to need to, we would need to be aggregating data across basically all clinical trials, right? That's really the way in which we can think about building big enough data sets to actually do machine learning. And, you know, that requires not just, that could be from one organization, say Pfizer is going to grab, they've done a lot of clinical trials, they could try to organize them all together. But even better, if we could really create large sort of repositories of information where sort of all clinical trials are really being incorporated and then used subsequently to improve, you know, medical research going forward. So rather than being a one-off thing where a trial happens and its data gets sort of buried someplace that no one ever gets to see again, we really should reuse that information to make future studies better.
So is that what you guys did at Pfizer or...
No, that's not what we did at Pfizer. But I was realizing at Pfizer that this was a problem. I was not involved in any efforts to try to do that there. I ended up leaving Pfizer to come to San Francisco to work at a virtual reality company. So it's totally different from anything I'd done before. My whole career was biophysics and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then I got this opportunity to VR. So I decided that would be interesting.
So what is this VR? Is this like a more consumer VR or is that something to do with the healthcare?
Nothing to do with healthcare. This is the only thing I've ever worked on that didn't have anything to do with healthcare or at all. It was just consumer focused VR. It was interesting. I'm not super, I got drawn back into healthcare pretty quickly. So this was now about 3 years ago or so that, myself and my two co-founders, John and Aaron, we were all working at that virtual reality company.
Okay.
And we all left at around the same time. And we were basically thinking about, how we could develop new machine learning technologies that might be really useful for solving some of these problems in medical research.
Okay.
So rather than taking like existing machine learning approaches, could we build something new that was really specific to these problems? And so that was, it was about 3.5 years ago or so when we all ended up quitting our job and, working from home and, your garage company for a while.
I just thought it's interesting that, you and your co-founders were working in this VR company that is more like consumer, and somehow both of you are interested in trying to solve the problem in a medical field. And, I mean, maybe what is the VR? There's so many VR. Like, what is the VR company that you were working on before you started this unlearn.ai?
Yeah. So we were all doing machine learning at this company called Leap Motion. And what they did was hand tracking, actually. So the idea would be you'd have cameras that would be, say, mounted on a virtual reality system, and they would take videos of your hands, and then you would try to translate that into the ability to interact with the virtual world with your hands. Which is kind of, it's interesting. Like, could you imagine having like a virtual glass and you could pick it up and stuff like that? And so it was all, but like we were really machine learning researchers there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the sort of origin of the idea of the company was really, if you look at machine learning and AI, and we see huge advances that are happening all the time, right? But most of those advances have really only been driven by like four or five companies. In collaboration with some academic groups, but it's all around certain areas of research, and particularly things related to images. So recognizing objects in images, for example, some work on natural language processing, understanding language, translating between different languages, and playing video games. And so those are like the three things where we've really made a lot of progress. What we were thinking about at the beginning is really looking for an area where we felt like was underserved. And actually, if you think about sort of biology in general, And medicine in particular, is that technology adoption in this space is actually quite slow compared to other areas. And so not as many resources have been devoted, I mean, still now, have been devoted to really saying, well, let's start with the problems that we encounter in biology and figure out what you would really do to solve that problem, right? And what tools would you need? And so we kind of felt like there was a hole. And that we could, that there would be interesting technology problems if we focused on this question of trying to learn, do machine learning on really clinical style data, because it's not something that anyone had really put a major dedicated effort to, you know. And I think, like, if you think about it in terms of R&D, I read somewhere that like NVIDIA spent like $500 million a year on R&D for like 10 years to develop their programming language called CUDA. You know, that level of R&D in the computer side, right? Like that happens in pharma for biology, but that has not happened for like computer side in pharma yet. And, you know, I think that if we can, you know, sort of start to drive that forward, that we're going to see, if we put in that level of kind of R&D across the board, that we're going to see really big gains in the utility of these methods within medical research.
Yeah, probably is good a time for maybe for us to hear, like, what does unlearn.ai
try to solve,
and then what's the technology? And...
Of course. So if we think about sort of the process of developing a drug and kind of bringing it to market, one of the major bottlenecks is when you really first try that drug in people. It takes clinical trials now take very, very long time, like better part of a decade. They cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and they actually usually fail. So most of the time, you end up with them failing. So is there some way that we could leverage all of the data, right? We can collect all of these data from previously run clinical trials, from electronic health records. How can we use those data to accelerate clinical trials, to make them faster, to make them more efficient, and to make them better? And that's really the fundamental question that we work on. And if you really, really wanted to think about a way to make clinical trials more efficient, the way we look at it is you would want to be able to run clinical trials to provide as good of evidence as you can, as strong of evidence, but with as few subjects as possible. So how can we do that? That's kind of the main goal. And so what we do is that we create a technology that where we take data from previously run trials, from electronic health records, and we use it to generate new patient data that is representative of patients in control groups of clinical trials.
How do you do that? How do you transfer, like, for previous clinical trial and create a new patient data?
Yeah, it's a so it's kind of a very technical process. I usually like to use this example where people can go in their web browser to this website called thispersondoesnotexist.com. And this was actually from NVIDIA. So I mentioned NVIDIA research before. They did this research. They built this website. And what they did is they got a big database of images, just pictures of people's faces. And then they trained a new kind of machine learning model that people call deep learning. They trained this to draw new faces of people. So it imagines a person and it draws a face. And these faces are amazing. They're photorealistic, like incredible high quality faces. And so, and you can actually go to this website now. Every time you refresh the page, it will draw a new photorealistic face. So what we do is something very analogous to that. We build big databases of patient level clinical data. And then we train a deep learning model so that it can generate new medical records. So it's actually just like that thing is generating faces. We are generating new medical records. And those the data that we use come largely from control arms of previously run clinical trials. So now when we generate things, we're generating new data that are representative of control groups in clinical trials for a particular disease, Alzheimer's disease being one of the first areas that we've really focused on. And one of the advantages to doing this with a computational model is that we can ask the model to generate really specific things. In fact, we can ask the model to generate essentially control groups for individual people. So the way that we kind of actually work in the context of a clinical trial is that when a patient enrolls in the study, so you have a real patient, they enroll in the study, and you are collecting all of their medical history and their baseline data at the beginning. What we'll do is we'll then take those data and we will say, well, let's generate a whole control group of digital twins, we call them, of these subjects who are matched to that one particular patient. So they have all of the same medical history up until the point of enrollment. And then this control group allows us to simulate what would likely happen to that patient if they were to receive a placebo. So then we can give that real patient a therapy and observe what happens. And we can simulate what would have happened in this matched placebo control group. And then at the end of the study, do a comparison to tell if that drug was effective.
So how does, when you do the simulation on how that digital twin react to placebo is validated, how do you know it's true?
So there are kind of three important things that we try to do in terms of this validation. Two of them I would call validation. One is a little bit different. So the first thing is that when we build these big databases of patient data from previously run trials, and then we're going to use them to train a model, we will only use like 80% of the data. So we'll leave 20% of the data out, don't show it to the model when it's being trained, and then use that to test the performance of the model. So can we make predictions about these 20% of patients that the model has never seen before? So that's kind of step one. People call that cross-validation. It's a standard statistical method. In addition to that, we perform retrospective and prospective validation studies. So a retrospective validation study might be that we work with an academic group or with a pharma company who has previously run a clinical trial in some disease area. And then we can basically act as if we were going to be running in real time. We get the baseline data. We create digital twins for all of those subjects and then do a reanalysis of that study. And then you can actually do two things. One is you can compare the simulated control group to the actual subjects who were in the control group of that study to make sure that there's a match. But also you can check to see that by incorporating these digital twins into the analysis, that you would really improve the inference, improve what you would learn from that study. And that kind of is the last part of it. It's really important to recognize, and there's a famous statistics quote by a statistician called, his name was George Box, I believe. And he said that all models are wrong, but some are useful. And statisticians say this quote all the time. So in addition to the fact that, we want to validate and demonstrate that our models are very, very accurate, we also recognize that they're not going to be perfect. Certainly not in the short run, right? And so a lot of the sort of other things that we do are thinking about what statistical methods can we use to incorporate these digital twins into a trial, to learn about the safety and efficacy of that therapy, but while retaining the different aspects of clinical trials that we want, right? We want it to still, say, be randomized, still be blinded, to control different types of errors. We don't want to increase the likelihood that somebody would make an error of judgment by using these clinical. In fact, we really like to reduce those probabilities of errors, right, relative. So that's the other aspect to it. Yes, we want to validate these models. We've done that through peer review. We have peer-reviewed publications. We've had meetings with FDA. We've done work with academic groups, we've done work with pharma companies, but we're also thinking about this sort of other step of that when you apply these methods, making sure that they're applied in a rigorous way that will lead to good evidence coming out of that study.
This podcast is sponsored by Ron Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group. a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrutnick.com.
So do you think using your algorithm or your platform technology, I don't know what you call that, it will reduce the number of patients getting placebo?
Yes.
Or exactly. Maybe can eliminate placebo completely one day.
Yeah, that last thing is a one day, is really a one day question. But yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, essentially, even if you are going to say, basically the way we do the analysis, you could think about having a confidence in how good your model is. And you could say, well, I have either zero confidence in my model, might be good, might be terrible, or I could have 100% confidence in my model. I'm sure that it's perfect. And you can reduce the number of subjects you need a placebo arm, regardless of where you all are along that axis. Even if you have no confidence in your model, you can still reduce the number of subjects that you need in your placebo arm. And you can do that in a way that will not cause you to have more errors. But you might be able to reduce them by like 20%, which is, that's good, but it's not 100%, right? And then as you get more and more confidence and how good your model is for generating these digital twins, how good are your predictions for what would happen to a patient if they received a placebo, you can reduce the size of the control arm more and more. And so over time, you know, a lot of the studies we're doing now are what we would call three-arm clinical trials, where you have a group of real subjects who are randomized to receive the experimental treatment. You have a group of real subjects who are randomized to receive a placebo. And then we also have these digital twins that are simulated placebos. So you actually have three sort of groups of patients in the study. And, you know, those are really what we're focusing on now. But they are, over time, generating more and more evidence so that we can shift that ratio of the probability that a patient is assigned to a placebo group. Is decreased over time as we generate more evidence. And in addition to that, you know, it's not just changing that ratio, it's shrinking the size of the trial. And I think that's something that's really important, because when we think about right now, the ability to find patients for trials is a major bottleneck. It's a major bottleneck across all different areas. And if we can reduce the number of patients that we need while still keeping a high bar of evidence, then we can speed up the whole ecosystem, right? The whole medical research community in these disease areas could be sped up dramatically. So that's one of the things when I think about measuring success for Unlearn over, you know, not over a period of 1 year, but let's say over 5-10 years, what is it we want to really measure? I'd like to measure the average amount of time it takes to complete a clinical trial. And if our approach is really being successful and we can get it adopted, I think that we can have a real measurable impact on the length of time it takes to run a trial that will be beneficial to the entire medical research community.
And hopefully the cost of drug will go down.
Yes. I mean, we obviously don't control how that would translate to the cost of drugs. And there are other systemic issues, right, with the cost of drugs that are beyond just the cost of clinical trials. But yes, I mean, I think, you know, in addition to it being good, obviously, for the community, I think this leads to trials that are, I think, more ethical and in line with what patients want. Certainly, it's another way I think about it as being an ethical use of patients' data, in that a patient volunteers for a clinical trial, right? And they really put themselves at some risk to do so. They take on some burden to do so, and their data are collected. And we should make the most out of those data for helping to find cures for that disease as we can. And so ensuring that the data aren't just taken and thrown away at the end of the trial, but that they're actually used to further research in that field, I think is really something that's also an ethical consideration.
So you started unlearn.ai 3 years ago. Where are you in terms of the stage of the company, in terms of the product deployment, and where do you want to take it from here?
So we are still what would be considered in the technology space an early stage emerging company. We've got about 16 employees now. And we have done quite a bit of work in Alzheimer's disease and some in multiple sclerosis, where we are working with some early adopters now in kind of the Alzheimer's disease space. In particular, we are actually working with a company who is running a phase 3 pivotal trial for a medical device aimed at the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And we are adding a what we call an intelligent control arm, a control arm constructed of these digital twins to that study. And that's actually, I believe, the trial's scheduled to be finished this fall, I think sometime in November. So it's going to be really interesting to get a readout of that trial and to, you know, be able to present those data, not only, you know, publish them and as a validation, but also if this device is very effective to you know, bring those data to FDA as part of a submission, I think will be a really interesting period for us this fall.
Where does the FDA stand in terms of, you know, doing the clinical study with your platform, especially when, you know, again, reducing the number of placebo? But I mean, in this case, you kind of run three arms, so mm-hmm. still okay, but at some point, there'll be not three arms anymore, right?
Yeah. I think that FDA is very interesting in that they really are an evidence evaluating organization. So we've had very, very supportive conversations with FDA. We had a meeting with FDA in the first week of March of this year to talk about our work in Alzheimer's disease. But the way that kind of works with them is that you present data and they evaluate the data. So if you present a concept, they're like, we're open to your concept, but bring us data, right? And so the work that we're doing now, these types of studies where you have three different arms and where you might change the randomization ratio, for example, but you still have real patients who are receiving a placebo in that study. We can control the operating characteristics of those studies in a way that is in line with current FDA guidance. And so it's likely that those types of studies would generally be acceptable, we think, to FDA. But those conversations happen really on a case-by-case basis. So you present your protocol and you get that evaluated. The question of once you start to decrease the size of the control arm more and more and more is really a question of evidence, right? So I think I said before that the ability to decrease the size of the control arm depends on how confident you are in the quality of the model. And so what we would really like to be able to do is to present more and more evidence over time for understanding what how high of quality these models are and really understanding where is that level that's appropriate, right, for reducing the size of the control arms and have that conversation with FDA and with the European Medicines Agency as well to really present them the evidence for this approach. And that's something that we're really having ongoing conversations about. I think that, you know, for us as a company, you know, working with the regulators is going to be something that we're just always doing, right? It's never going to be a day where we're going to say, oh, we don't have to work with the regulators anymore. Like our chosen business is something where, you know, we really view them as an important stakeholder. Right? And we want to make sure that what we are doing is in line with what they would approve of. And so that's always been something that's important to us.
And I believe FDA is aligned with their goal as well. I think if they can reduce the number of patients getting the placebo, that I think, I mean, they're trying to make all that clinical trials to be more efficient. It seems, at least I read it somewhere, that's where they're interested in.
Yeah, clinical trial efficiency is definitely one of the things that they want. The key aspect, of course, is being able to do it without lowering the bar of evidence, right? That's always the thing. And, you know, that's something that, by the way, I don't think is just something that we care about because that's what the regulators care about. It's also, you know, the right thing to do, right? All of us are medical consumers in the end, right? So, you know, we really do want, you know, medicine to be advanced as much as we can. I think that one aspect of the regulatory thing that's a bit different is that, you know, we are ultimately a software company. And it is also interesting to think about just the regulatory landscape for software companies these days. It's an area where, you know, we've also tried to engage with FDA a bit on this because software is still kind of new in pharma. And there's actually not clear regulations in a lot of ways on how software is going to be treated and who validates it and what does validation mean. There are regulations for software that is a medical device that's actually being used to treat a person. But when you step back from that and say, well, this is not software that's being used to treat, it's just used in the clinical trial, it's not clear actually what standards apply. And it's an area that we think is important and are hoping that there will be some movement towards actually setting up real standards for what would be expected of software that's not directly a medical device, but is used as part of the research process.
Which I'm sure not just in the regulatory side of thing, but in terms of investor side of thing, how, you know, you got some funding from DCVC, I believe. So, you know, when you look for fundraising activities, like, do you go to a pharma company or do you go more to the software kind of, not company, software kind of and investors, or do you kind of go to both?
Yeah, it is a mixture. And the earlier stage you are, so when we just started out our company, yeah, we raised some venture capital from DCVC, and we were three people working from their couch, like it's not, you know, and you know, that's technology investor land. That's what they do, right? But as we are getting sort of more mature as a company, so we just raised we're actually raising more capital actually now. So we'll be raising more capital. So as we raise more and more capital, we are starting to have conversations with strategic investors from pharma investors, from CROs, for example. And I think that we'll be bringing on some new investors from that crowd soon.
So that's great. And one last question before we go offline is, with the current pandemic, COVID-19, how is your technology can help, you know, reduce the impact or increase the efficiency of healthcare that we face right now?
So there are kind of two things that we could imagine. So I'll actually start with the negative. And so we've gotten some interest. A few people have reached out to us about whether or not we could apply this approach directly in COVID-19 therapeutics trials. And theoretically, yes, we could do that. The thing is that, you know, we are really, really focused on ensuring that the data that we use to train these models is of extremely high quality. And so we really, really need good data. And COVID-19 being a new disease and being kind of a chaotic environment, the data as of right now is sort of kind of all over the map. No one knows how to believe in it. That, you know, doctors were just kind of giving people stuff, right? They're just like, try all of the medicine. So it wasn't really done in a very controlled way because it's just brand new. It's so chaotic. And as we get more and more information, that might be something that we look into. But I also think that people sort of are neglecting the impact this is having on other diseases, right? I mean, many hospitals completely stopped doing all unnecessary care, right? And that has meant that, well, first of all, there are a large number of people who have other conditions where they have essentially not had those conditions treated for a while, right? And in the context of clinical trials in many, many other disease areas effectively stopped. And that's going to be a really big problem for the pharma, you know, community, like, because there are these trials that kind of half enrolled and then stopped, and now they're too small. And, you know, that could be a big waste of resources and really set back research, you know, for years, actually, on these other disease areas. And, you know, our whole value proposition is that we leverage data and machine learning to be able to run clinical trials with fewer subjects. And so now we are in a situation where, because of some external event, many clinical trials have ended up with fewer subjects than they had planned. And that's actually, I think, a really good opportunity for us to partner with companies who are in that situation, particularly in Alzheimer's disease. And to which, by the way, is where many trials have been impacted because of the elderly population that's been particularly at risk of COVID-19. And to really leverage this approach to try to improve the power, salvage some of those trials that have been disrupted by the pandemic. And that's, we're having some of those conversations now. And I think that's actually going to be an area where we'll be able to demonstrate an impact of our technology faster, actually, than we would have if it had not been for this global pandemic.
Well, that's great. You know, I think there's always a winner and a loser in the pandemic. And I hope you're one of the
winners. I'm not sure if any of us really are winners in the pandemic.
No.
I'm not sure. But you know, at least good news there, right? Things are actually starting to move along in COVID-19 research too, so.
Yeah, no, I think every bit helps. Well, thank you so much. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening today. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.